And we're back. Data Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And shortly we'll be talking to Joel Richardson about this project of the record for suit men. We're going to work. He's going to explain all this to us. Let me just ask Phil. Do we have no particular announcements? Do we? No.
Well, there is the event on the 6th, which is Thursday night at Betzatun about Syria. Actually,
that's right. Some recent visitors.
That's right. Somebody who's recently there, who's a lawyer and a journalist, and that'll be Betzatun Thursday evening at 7 p.m. at 612 Markham Street. $5 admission.
And Joel's date is going to be June 9, and we'll be learning about that. By the way, we should say that we're guest hosting on CIUT Friday morning at 9 to 10. So we have great film reviews and theater reviews. Lynn Slotkin and Daniel Garber. We hope you'll tune in for that. And we're joined now by Joel Richardson. Are you there?
I am. I'm here, Phil.
You don't mind if I call you joelrichardson.com, right?
So no, not at all. If you don't mind, I call you Phil Taylor Report.
You're good. Thank you. You just call me Report for short.
Okay, sounds good, Report.
we have a nice segue. The whole country of Turkey is up, having an uprising over a development. They don't like the idea of losing green space. And a lot of people in Toronto are kind of concerned about developments, and you're trying to lend a hand. So what are you doing?
That's right. Well, Phil, we're going to go for a world record of most people sitting and meditating in suits. And the idea is to raise awareness around what's happening with development in Toronto, specifically, you know, bringing in towers into low-rise neighborhoods. And that's what we're going to do Sunday at 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. The location we're keeping secret until 24 hours in advance. Mm-hmm. People can go to my website, joelrichardson.com. They can get information about it.
And so on the day you post, you'll say, okay, here's where we are, right?
That's right. Boom, like a bit of a flash mob style.
Oh, that's fun.
Absolutely.
Sunday at 1 o'clock, and you've done some of this before, right? I've seen some photographs of people in suits. They appear to be meditating. What is that a practice or what was that?
Well, yeah, I've been using people in suits in my artwork for a while, and I've been kind of playing around with these human installations. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we did something at in the banking district last summer. Mm-hmm. We had people come down there and sit and meditate in suits. And it was very successful. And, again, part of the idea is about creating these photos, creating these images, because I'm a visual artist. I really believe in the power of images. So, you know, this juxtaposition of people in suits meditating the financial district, and on Sunday it'll be in a neighborhood, and you know, part of the idea is to create these images that hopefully we put out there and they kind of echo and give a reference point for this not just a battle, but we're also trying to inspire for these developers to have vision. We don't want it to just be against these guys. I think people are excited about Toronto expanding and growing, but we just wanted there to be some sense of vision.
Yeah. Well, that's good, the challenge. I mean, you're giving them a chance to come over. Red Rover, I dare you to come over.
That's right.
And a lot of those developers do wear suits, so they're already ready, you know, set for this. They've got the apparel. By the way, you have shown in the past the power of images. I remember, wasn't it the Ford administration that took an interest in one of your murals and asked you to redo it. Where is that mural? Where can people go see that?
Well, that's it's on DuPont, just west of Lansdowne. Actually, the city of Toronto has just assisted me in doing a few repairs on the mural over the last weekend. Uh-huh. And yeah, that's on DuPont, both sides of the underpass, just west of Lansdowne.
Just west of Lansdowne. Yeah, I've been by. It's a great piece of work. I'm really glad to hear it's been refreshed.
That's right. I'm very pleased myself.
So I think you found some sort of understanding with the city. The city is always a little nervous when they see a muralist. I seem to recall Diego Rivera had some problems with people not liking and not being too happy with some of the people in his work.
Yeah, I remember that also. Well, I don't remember it, but
yeah. Well, now you became rather well known not just in our city but in New York during the Occupy movement. Refresh us on that subject. I recall you went down there and they were glad to see you.
That's right. Well, it was a bit of a perfect storm because my work has been using components of finance and especially these huge mathematic equations used in finance, like the Black-Scholes equation. So I was playing with this stuff beforehand, and then the Occupy movement hit, and it was just, and then my mural got erased. It just got all swept up together. I got invited down to do a show in the old J.P. Morgan building right on Wall Street, right across from the New York Stock Exchange.
You were inside the J.P. Morgan building?
Oh, yeah. I got to stencil the walls inside the J.P. Morgan building.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was amazing.
I know it's an overdone cliche about people turning in their graves, but I have to think that the J.P. Morgan was not happy with the Joel Richardson.
I'm quite sure.
By the way, now you got a great website, joelrichardson.com. Are some of the work that you did there, the J.P. Morgan, is that? Can we find that at your site?
Yeah, you can probably find it in there in the Flickr feed, or definitely if you go to my blog, there's definitely lots of stuff. You know, there was a reference in the New York Times. There was all kinds of coverage. So, yeah, you can find that on my blog, mm-hmm. again, all through my website.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what's again about now people who are resisting sort of autocratic approach to development. What are some of the things they do and that you hear from them that inspires you?
Some of the people standing up against these things.
Yeah. What's yes. Is,
well, I
mean, did
I can't
you come to them or they come to you?
But I see a lot of exciting things happening with people organizing online. And, you know, I've been really inspired by this Idle No More movement. Mm-hmm. You know, even things like the Arab Spring, it seems people are waking up and trying to organize themselves using this technology that's evolving before our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So that really excites me.
Oh, by the way, yeah, now I was raised the issue of Turkey. Seriously speaking, in fact, that is what's happening there. I mean, the population of Istanbul, that's a wonderful, beautiful city, and they really don't like being kind of dictated to by bankers and developers who want to alter the look of the place. And I understand that the prime minister said yesterday that he hates Twitter.
Yeah, that it's some kind of scourge. Yeah. Well, that it's he should start worrying because all the other guys who've come out with those statements aren't really with us anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, he probably should have started with, what's Twitter? That might
yeah,
have
that's right.
A little more respect.
That's right.
This is Joel Richardson, joelrichardson.com. Now, let's review again. You're going to do what on the 9th?
Sunday, June the 9th, 1 p.m., at a neighborhood near you. We're going to be getting together as many people as we can in suits and ties. We're going to sit on the street and meditate and contemplate, put out good vibes raise awareness of development with vision in Toronto and beyond.
I like joelrichardson.com. Make sure that's where you got to go for the information, right? If you on Sunday, when they get up, they have to go, okay, go to joelrichardson.com and they'll get the message, right?
That's exactly right.
This is the first time I've ever been invited to a demonstration where they say you have to wear a suit and tie.
That's right.
Is that how we protest against the suits and ties, is to put them on?
Well, you know, my understanding of the background of the dark suit and tie is during the French Revolution, when they gathered together the Estate General, there were very specific rules of what each class of people could wear. And the bottom class of people were told they could only wear dark cravats, dark three-point hats, and dark suits. So the dark suit actually became a symbol of the revolution, and to align with the revolutionaries, you would not wear your gold frills and your big flowery hat. You'd wear a dark suit.
Yeah. Well, I never did have a flowery hat, but I think I ought to get a black suit. Well, Joel, that's a great story. We look forward to it. I bet you set a record. It will be. There is no record at the moment, so we're going to set
a record.
That's
right. It's a wide-open category.
Man, that's going to be great. JoelRichardson.com. Hey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Phil. It's always a great pleasure.
Okay. And good luck. We'll talk to you again, maybe right afterwards. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I hope to see you there on Sunday, Phil.
Okay. I'll get find my black suit. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. See you. That's Joel Richardson. As you all know him as JoelRichardson.com. And go to that site. Make sure you get your preparatory material. And then on Sunday, June 9, be looking for the signal to where to go at 1 p.m. and help set a record and to offer the developers a chance to meditate on what they've been doing and how they might find a vision. So this is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. And, of course, Phil Connan is with us. And, Phil, let's talk about you have a program coming up tomorrow at noon. What are you featuring?
Well, we are, and I think we're probably the first media to talk about this. The Canadian conductor Mario Bernardi died yesterday morning, and he was 81 years old. And we are actually going to have one of his friends come on the program and present some of his recordings and talk about
his career.
Did
you say one of his sons?
No, one of his friends.
Friends,
was,
good.
As, Bernardi led the CBC orchestra for many, many years. Of course, no such thing exists anymore. The Tories took care of that with their budget cuts, and he was the conductor of the National Arts Center Orchestra for many, many years.
And the program, by the way, just is classical.
Classical underground. Classical, and then we will do our other
and that's at 12.
Fun things. There's a political issue that is of interest to people in classical music that came up again today in Queen's Park, which is that and it's really maddening because of who the premier is and who her education minister is. But the province of Ontario is forcing the City of Toronto School Board to get rid of what they call itinerant music teachers. These are the teachers that do...
Itinerant
music teachers, that's what they're called. These are specialized teachers who come into the schools and they do choir, glee club, and instrumental training. And there are some guys in suits, unfortunately, same kind of guys who count beans, who said the Toronto School Board is spending too much money and has told pretty much the school board, well, you don't want us to have to put you under administration, so you're going to have to cut some money. So why don't you get rid of these music teachers? And so it came up on the floor of the legislature today. It will leave one Toronto school child in three without any form of music education in elementary school at all. And by the way, the schools that will be mostly affected at this tend to be in the poorer neighborhoods. So, and that is Premier Catherine Wynne, folks, the one who used to talk about this issue from the other side when she paraded herself as the great savior against Mike Harris.
Yeah, you say you're going to take that up tomorrow?
We're going to take that up on the program, and we're going to play a clip of some of the debate in the legislature today. So,
Children, people have hopes for their children and all that, and you look at the old family pictures, and very often the kid is there with their instrument.
Of course.
Or showing them with a group and appearing on stage. I mean, one of the things, you want to go hear how the kid's doing. You also want to see something that they're doing together, and going to see them perform something. Mm-hmm. That was as part of the, we hope, part of our lives. But as you say, bean counters... who, of course, their children are playing instruments.
Oh, if they want to, absolutely they are. But, of course, you see, in order to do these things, you have to get the people with money to pay taxes. And, of course, we have a political class that says that the wealthy people shouldn't have to pay taxes. And so that's why we are forced to see these kind of decisions being made. I mean, mm-hmm. you can't run a school board if you don't have funds. And and even though the premier can talk nice noises about how much he cares about education, if you don't provide them with the ability to pay for it, then which is what the issue comes down to, they just don't want to spend money to teach working class kids music.
Yeah, we all know, again, there's an aspect of this, is that people know that when someone feels good about themselves, mm-hmm. they learn to master something. That's part of their raises their confidence to learn in other areas and also to have an identity with their schoolmates and families there's a fellowship that intellectually enriching. And no, I you know, we're having these demonstrations about developers, et cetera, but there ought to be this kind of thing ought to be forbidden. You have to say, no, don't touch that.
Of course.
You know. Yeah. But, you know, you start surrendering, like you already mentioned, the CBC got rid of their orchestra and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, every time you give up ground, it makes it easier to take away down the road. And, of course, we're living under this strange concept of austerity, which is found based on a bunch of data that now turns out to be cooked, where the great thinkers, and they always mention, they bring in the reference to Harvard or someplace, and it turns out that, no, it's a crook. It's a liar and a crook. And, yes, he is at Harvard, and that shouldn't surprise us. But they provide us with data. And just to make a segue there, you're aware of this gentleman that they caught out who
absolutely produced it's a wonderful story. Great study proved that if you didn't have austerity, the capitalists couldn't make money and society, economic activity couldn't
continue. And then turns out a real student, an actual one who does math, looked at the numbers and said, this doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, and by the way, when you say looked at the numbers, what he actually did was he just verified their arithmetic. And they said, these guys made arithmetic mistakes in this calculation. And it's something, the guy who caught it said, actually, any high school student has the skills, if he's a good math student in high school, would have the skills to have caught what we caught. He says, it's just these guys didn't check their work, right? Because they got the result that they wanted to get.
And this was ideology. And they figured, who's going to look at these are guys who sell used cars or whatever it was, so the fine print. Who's going to look at that? And fortunately, there was a guy who looked at it. And then it fell apart. But then, of course, they found that this individual involved in the manufacturing, the austerity story, is the one who also had a theory about black students and their inferiority. And Harvard had to separate themselves from him. But he had argued, the old IQ business. That had been shown up, and a lot of people said, well, how did he go from there to getting employment with these people who were cooking a new one?
Yeah.
And it always turns out that, powerful people know how to
protect each other. And further on this same subject, there was the professor who made the speech about John Maynard Keynes, and he said, well, Keynes's theories were all wrong. And that's because Keynes was gay and didn't have children. He actually said this in a speech. This is a big mathematician at Harvard. He said this in a speech to other mathematicians. And then when, of course, somebody reported on it, he said, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. That wasn't...
I shouldn't have got caught saying that.
That's what he really...
Very important not to get caught saying that. People at Harvard are supposed to learn how to not to get caught. But, we're in thrall of these, the flashing credentials, which is, if you look at the World Bank and IMF, for example, all these people have, they always say, oh, he went to Harvard, he went to Yale. By the way, a Yale graduate gave a speech yesterday or day before on the birthday, I think it was, Shimon Peres in Israel, that would be Bill Clinton. He received $500,000 for that speech. And I saw the picture of him. He was smiling a bigger smile than usual.
Well,
$500,000 put a pretty big grin on your
face. My question is this. Since Yale is the B team, would he have been paid more if he'd gone to Harvard?
That's the only debate the Americans have. Is it Harvard or is it Yale? Frankly, you'd be better off with Bakersfield Junior College as far as I'm concerned. That was one of the great lines somebody got off the said, I'd rather be ruled by the first 100 names in the phone book than by people from Harvard. And I would agree with him. While we're dealing in proverbs and cliches, I read a very good one, and somebody was ranting at one of these websites, but they had a quote from Mark Twain. It stands up rather well. He says, it's easier to fool somebody than to convince them that they've been fooled.
Wow. Yeah, that's good old Mark Twain. That's a great and how true that is.
Yeah, no, the people in the fool business, they're doing quite well. But if you're like Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, people like that, and you try to say, no, this is how he fooled you, they don't want to hear that they were fooled. That's the last thing they want to hear. I want to mention a historical date that's coming up that I've been looking into, just worthwhile, I think. The Battle of Beaver Dam, we're doing our history business. So 200 years ago in June 1813, there was a British victory. I'll remind you that there was an Anglo-American war. You don't have to get involved if you're a Canadian because it was Anglo-Americans. You can choose any side you like. You could even choose Napoleon, which, by the way, is probably the better choice. But so there was the Anglo-American War of 1812, and which the British have forgotten. I know that the people here want to remember and remember, but the British didn't know it. They don't really know much about the War of 1812, because what they do remember, there was a guy named Napoleon. That was enough to think about. They don't think about all it. But there was a victory at a place called Beaver Dams, and they're encouraging us all to go there and to tend to follow the trail of Laura Secord. And I always ask myself, after having read a lot about this, why anybody would care? Why would we talk about Laura Secord so much? She wasn't at the battle, and we know she was a loyalist, etc. But the people who were at the battle are kind of important. It was the one battle which was conducted entirely by Native Americans. These were Mohawks from Montreal, and they were led by a man named Ducharme. And Ducharme brought them on the orders of the British commander, Prevost. He came to help buttress the position in the Niagara Peninsula of the British. What they were worried about was Fort George, who had been occupied by the Americans, and they didn't want them leaving the fort. So they were harassing. Now, here's how much they were harassing. The Americans could barely go out and try to forage around the fort to find something to eat. They were being attacked by Ducharme's Mohawks. And they were losing casualties, which means that the native element were watching that fort like hawks. So when that party of 500 Americans left the fort with two wagons and a couple of cannons and started south to go to look for a British outpost 25 miles away, that was not a secret. I appreciate that Laura went through the woods and said they're coming, but every Mohawk knew they were coming. As a matter of fact, when she finally burst out of the woods, she burst into the arms of a bunch of Mohawks who said, "Hi." And then she said, "Could you take me to the leader?" And they said, "I suppose." So they took her to the leader, and then she said, "Guess what? They're coming." And I'm sure he thought to himself, "Oh, boy." Now somebody else knows. We've been watching these guys come now for some time, and now it turns out everybody knows. But at any rate, all they did was set an ambush, bless their hearts, and shot the devil out of the Americans. And the Americans said, "Can we give up now?" And so then James Fitzgibbon comes out of the woods, and he says, with a white flag, and he says, "You know they're going to scalp you, don't you, unless you surrender." So the American commander said, "Can I surrender to you, and you protect me from them?" He said, "Yes." So that was arranged. Now, later, the commander of the Mohawks, by the way, there were 100 Mohawks, came from Grand River. But the commander of the 400 that came from Montreal, his name Ducharme, wrote to Fitzgibbon, and they said, "You know, it bothers us that you are being called the victor, and we did all the fighting." And so he wrote them a letter saying, "Let's be clear. Nobody that I was commanding fired a shot. All the shots were fired by the Indians, and they are the ones who won the victory." So then the question came up, well, why didn't Mr. Ducharme, who was the commander of the 300 Mohawks, why didn't he claim credit? And they said, very simple, why didn't he take the surrender of the American officer? They said, he couldn't. He didn't speak English. So in other words, you should know that the 300 or 400 Mohawks who came from Quebec, that is, Lower Canada, and fought, they were converts. They'd been converted by the Jesuits. So they are Roman Catholics, French-speaking, by the way, and they came and fought on the Niagara Peninsula and set the ambush that captured 500 Americans. So we're not celebrating the Mohawks. We're not celebrating Mr. Ducharme, who was the commander. Instead, we're celebrating a lady who ran through the woods and saying, oh, if she hadn't done that. I'm sorry to tell you, that's one of the silliest stories that anybody ever conjured up. I mean, here they are watching and besetting and killing Americans. Every time they leave the fort, they kill them. And so they need her to tell them that they have, 500 of them have come out of the fort and they have a wagon and they're going through the mud and it's going to take them 2 days to get to your post. You think that the Mohawks didn't know? I assume that the only thing that worried them was that if she knows, a bunch of people must know. They had this lovely little ambush set. And by the way, they did scalp. They did take scalps. But that was part of British policy because they wanted to make sure that the Americans were petrified. I mean, that's what was going on. Now, last point on the war 200 years ago. At this, you should know that the summer of 1813 was the big one because the other big commander of the West, Mr. Proctor, was over on south of the Lake Erie attempting to capture the forts of the in the Ohio area, which would have been the great victory that Tecumseh and everybody wanted. So the summer was devoted on the right flank of the British Army to trying to capture the Ohio Valley, and that was an utter failure. At the end, coming up in October, we're going to be marking the end of the effort when Tecumseh was killed on the Thames River, and the British, when they negotiated the Treaty of Ghent, tossed the native claims out the window, and they lost the entire Ohio Valley. So very important to note. As for what was gained, I think that we ought to be commemorating Ducharme and the Mohawks for their fighting in Niagara, but I doubt that we're going to hear much about that. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5, and thank you, Phil Conlon, and thank you, Terry, and thank you, Andy, and we'll see you next week.